the opening lecture in this Frederick Douglass series last week by Professor Benjamin Quarles, I think, brought out quite clearly the fact that Frederick Douglass was indeed a great American and not just simply a local boy who became prominent. We're actually very much indebted for last week's lecture to this week's lecturer. It was he who called our attention to the fact that Mr. Quarles is the authority on the life of Frederick Douglass, and I was just telling him that he set himself, you look at it one way, he set himself a standard that he's going to have a hard time surpassing, so maybe he set up an obstacle for himself, but on the other hand, he has established so much credit that he's already a winner no matter how he performs this evening. This is a repeat performance for Professor Franklin. He lectured here in the President's Lecture Series a couple of years ago, and he talked about the historical background of the Civil Rights Revolution that was then current. Mr. Franklin graduated with honors from Fisk. He has two master's degrees, one from Harvard University and one from Cambridge University. He's now a professor of history at the University of Chicago. Prior to that, he was chairman of the Department of History at Brooklyn College. He's been visiting professor at Cambridge University, at the Australian National University, at Harvard University, Wisconsin, and Cornell. And he has quite a variety of professional activities. He spent 15 years as an editor of the Journal of Negro History. He's a member of the Council of the American Historical Association. He's a director of the American Council of Learned Societies. He's a director of the Salzburg Seminar in American Studies, of which our own Dexter Perkins was one of the founders and is a director. He's a member of the U.S. National Commission for UNESCO, director of the American Council on Human Rights, a member of the Board of Foreign Scholarships, and indeed has been good many other activities that I will not go into now. One of the more interesting of his current activities is that of editing a new series of high school textbooks that are designed to emphasize the role of minority groups in American history. It's a real pleasure to welcome Professor Franklin once more to the University of Rochester. His topic tonight is Douglass 75 Years Later. Professor Franklin.
Mr. President, members of the university community, ladies and gentlemen, 125 years ago, a young abolitionist of indomitable will and incredible courage, indeed a man of genius, visited Rochester for the first time. There was as yet no university, but Rochester was a growing, bustling town, and the cordial and progressive community received the young man with open arms, and he fell in love with it. The fact that this young man was a Negro, Frederick Douglass, was the one thing that set him apart from a procession of ambitious, resourceful, and enterprising young Americans who were then seeking their fortunes in the new and prosperous area of Western New York. And the warm and cordial treatment that Rochester accorded Douglass in the year 1842 set this city apart from many of its neighboring cities in the way it received abolitionists, and particularly Negro abolitionists. Douglass's hosts, Isaac and Amy Post, two people of all abounding benevolence, were not more amiable, Douglass said, than brave. For they never seemed to ask, what will the world say? But they walked straight forward in what seemed to them a line of duty, please or offend whomsoever it might. The Posts and others like them made it easy for Douglass to move to Rochester 5 years later, and in the ensuing 25 years, to become one of the first citizens of the Flower City. There would scarcely be a time when Douglas's feeling for Rochester waned in enthusiasm, and the feeling was mutual. During the years that he made Rochester his home and conducted his abolitionist activities from there, he was grateful for the cordiality and understanding that the citizens of the city extended him. Even when his home was destroyed by fire in 1872, he harbored no lifelong bitterness in the great loss that he knew was the result of arson. When the people of Rochester honored him by placing a marble bust commemorating his distinguished services in this university, after he became a resident of Washington, he was moved almost beyond expression. The city honored few citizens in death as it honored Douglas by having his remains lie in state in the city hall with the mayor and the aldermen heading the list of notables who paid their last respects to this giant of a man who had adopted a city that in turn adopted him. If Douglas loved Rochester, he loved no less the country that he served in a dozen honorable ways. It was because he loved the United States so much that he sought constantly to make it a better place for all its people. Again and again, he spoke of its beauty, of its wealth, its power, its capacity for growth and improvement. It was his confidence in the capacity of the nation to extend justice to all that on one occasion he said in a moment of despair, "There is heart and eloquence still left in the councils of the nation, and these will, I trust, yet make themselves potent in having both the Constitution of 1789 and the Constitution with the 14th and 15th Amendments made practically the law of the land for all the people thereof." I wonder if you would like to come and sit down here. I'm a bit uncomfortable with your standing. No disturbance to me, whatever. No defect in American life escaped the searching criticism and searching scrutiny and withering criticism of Douglas. And during his lifetime, there were so many glaring deficiencies in American life, and indeed so many that were pervasive, that they kept a sensitive person like Douglas not only busy, but outraged as well. As one views Douglas hammering away at the defective aspects of American life, and as one begins to appreciate the relevance of his criticisms to the present condition, one wonders if it was the prescience of the man or the persistence of the problems that makes Douglas's commentaries today so timely. He lived through the period when the District of Columbia lost its right of self-government. And as a resident of the capital, and as one who was deeply committed to the principle of self-rule, Douglas was greatly distressed over the disfranchisement of Washingtonians. "The District of Columbia," he said, "is the one spot where there is no government for the people, of the people, and by the people. Its citizens submit to rulers whom they have had no choice in selecting. They obey laws which they had no voice in making. They have a plenty of taxation, but no representation. I have nothing to say in favor of this anomalous condition of the people of the District of Columbia, and hardly think that it ought to be, or indeed that it will be, longer endured." The analysis was cogent, but the prediction fell far short of the mark. Except for the recent grudging concession to them to participate in presidential elections, the people of the District of Columbia seem no closer to effective self-government today than they were when Douglas made his remarks in 1885. From the time of emancipation, which Douglas had urged upon President Lincoln with all the power that he could command, the future of the Negro in the United States was of continuing concern to him. He scoffed at the idea that the Negro would become extinct, as many whites believed and perhaps hoped. Douglas said in 1884 that in one form and complexion or another, the Negro may be counted upon as a permanent element in the population of the United States. He is now 7 millions. has doubled his number in 30 years and is increasing more rapidly than the more favored population of the South. If the Negro was here to stay, then he should remain in the South, Douglas said. If the Negro's best future lay in the South, and Douglas took every opportunity to counsel against mass migration, he did not countenance the argument that Negroes should move to the North in order to escape the violence and the intimidation to which they were subjected in the South. The business of this nation is to protect its citizens where they are, he said, not to transport them where they will need no protection. When a considerable number of Negroes began to move north in the late 1870s, Douglas was greatly distressed. It is a surrender, he said, a premature, disheartening surrender, since it would secure freedom and free institutions by migration rather than by protection, by flight rather than right. It leaves the whole question of equal rights on the soil of the South open and still to be settled, with the moral influence of the Exodus against us, since it is a confession of the utter impracticability of equal rights and equal protection in any states where those rights may be struck down by violence. There were other reasons, moreover, why Douglas urged Negroes to remain in the South. Migration would dilute their political power and their influence and render impossible their election to office in the North, where they would inevitably be outnumbered, and in the South, where their numbers would be diminished. Migration would also destroy the Negroes' firm hold on the labor market in the South, Douglas believed. There, in the South, the Negro would be in a position to sell his labor on terms more favorable than in the North, where he would be compelled to compete with immigrant labor. This, of course, was an obviously oversimplified analysis of the position of the Negro in the South in 1879. Already, the position of the Negro worker there was at best marginal. In the immediate future, it would become even more tenuous with the rise of industry from which the Negro was generally excluded or in which he was given only the most lowly jobs. It is significant that Douglas did not argue that Negroes should remain in the South because of possible violence in the streets that might be occasioned by their mass migration into northern communities. Douglas was impressed by the fact that the scenes of lawless violence against the Dutch and Irish in New York and Boston had all but disappeared. And of course, he had no way of knowing that his beloved Rochester, that had a mere 500 Negroes in 1880, would have some 25,000 in 1960, and that their presence would create animosities and problems that would tax the resources and the ingenuity of every segment of the community. He would have been appalled, of course, to contemplate the prospect that by 1960, more than one-third of the Negro population of 22 millions would live in 12 metropolitan areas of the North and West, under conditions of discrimination in housing, employment, and education that would indeed have terrified Douglas. His remarks against mass migration out of the South were ineffective when he uttered them, and they would be more ineffective in succeeding years. But this is not to say that Douglas lacked wisdom and insight into the problems that Negro Americans faced during his time. Nor is it to assert that he would be overwhelmed or rendered speechless by the gigantic problems that Negro Americans face at the present time. For Douglas knew too well the pervasive character of American racism in the late 19th century. And if he was a bit sanguine about the eventual triumph of justice, he was certain that it would not come overnight. Nowhere in the world, he said, are the worth and dignity of mankind more exalted in speech and in press than they are here. But nowhere in the world is manhood pure and simple more despised than here. We affect contempt for caste and aristocracies of the old world and laugh at their assumptions. But at home, we foster pretensions far less rational and much more ridiculous. Even so, Douglas confidently believed that there was reason for optimism. If, in his view, liberty was not yet more than a name, and if, in his view, the suffrage was only a cruel mockery, he rejoiced that the laws and the institutions of the country were sound, just, and liberal. It was indeed because Douglass believed that the framework of the American social order was sound that he wrote and spoke and worked so hard to induce the American people to conduct their lives and order their relationships within the framework of the American social order. Nowhere is this view more clearly set forth than in his remarks about the decision of the United States Supreme Court in 1883 that declared the Civil Rights Act of 1875 unconstitutional. Douglass, of course, diffident and modest at times as he was, said in his opening speech, in the opening of his speech, that he had no right to view the decision as a lawyer would. And then he proceeded to declare that in striking down a law that under the 14th Amendment sought to confer on Negroes the rights that white people and others enjoyed, the court acted in defiant disregard, he said, of what was the object and the intent of the 14th Amendment. What concerned Douglass most of all was the significance of the act and the implications of its being struck down. He said, "It is said that this decision will make no difference to the treatment of colored people, that the Civil Rights Bill was a dead letter, and some have claimed that it could not be enforced." Now, there is some truth to all this, but it is not the whole truth. That bill, like all advanced legislation, was a banner to the outer wall of American liberty, a noble moral standard uplifted for the education of the American people. This law, though dead, did speak. It expressed the sentiment of justice and fair play common to every honest heart. Its voices were against popular prejudice and meanness. It appealed to all the noble and patriotic instincts of the American people. It told the American people that they were all equal before the law, that they belonged to a common country, and that they were equal citizens. The Supreme Court has now hauled down this flag of liberty in open day and before all the people, and has hereby given joy to the heart of every man who wishes to deny to others what he claims for himself. It is a concession to race pride, to selfishness and meanness, and will be received with joy by every upholder of caste in the land. It was in the broad area of civil rights that Douglass wrote and spoke with a poignancy and a sensitivity that make his views so relevant 75 years and more after he uttered them. The United States Commission on Civil Rights was established under an act passed by Congress in 1957, more than a half century after the death of Douglass. The Commission's fields of inquiry, housing, voting, education, employment, and the administration of justice, are the same fields with which Douglass was so deeply concerned. And his remarks about the deficiencies in those fields could well have been testimony taken by the Commission on Civil Rights in one of its many hearings. During Douglass's later years, the problem of housing for Negroes was just becoming an acute one. And in those days, it emerged largely as a northern problem. In the South, of course, most Negroes lived in rural areas. In the towns and cities, they lived almost everywhere. For no great importance was attached in the South to the fact that some Negroes lived among the whites, as had been true, of course, before the Civil War. If they did live among the whites, it was assumed that they were there for the convenience and the service of the whites. This, of course, created no problem, certainly no problem regarding churches or schools or social intercourse, for all the Negroes knew their place. And if they did not, they would soon learn. In the North, on the other hand, there was the tendency to herd Negroes into some particular section of the city. This would make it easy to segregate them and, in turn, to discriminate against them in various spheres. This was the beginning of New York's Harlem, of Brooklyn's Bedford-Stuyvesant, of Detroit's Paradise Valley, and of Chicago's South Side. There ensued a pattern of segregation and discrimination in housing that was in full flower when the United States Commission on Civil Rights began to study the matter in 1957. It led the commission 2 years later to conclude that, first, a considerable number of Americans, by reason of their color or race, are being denied equal opportunity in housing, and second, the housing disabilities of colored Americans are part of a national housing crisis involving the general shortage of low-cost housing. The commission's findings that housing seems to be one commodity in the American market that is not freely available on equal terms to everyone who can afford to pay it is about as true in 1967 as it was in 1957. And that is why the President of the United States quite recently, in an effort to redeem a pledge that had been made when the first National Housing Act was passed, this is why the President set up a timetable a few weeks ago, a timetable of 3 years, in which he called for the complete elimination of racial barriers in housing. While Douglas did not frequently address himself to the problem of housing for Negroes, he was sensitive to the inadequacies as well as the frequent violations of the sanctity of Negro homes. Speaking in 1883, he said that after 20 years of so-called emancipation, we are still subject to lawless raids of midnight riders who, with blackened faces, invade our homes and perpetrate the foulest of crimes upon us and upon our families. This condition, he continued, is too flagrant and too notorious to require specifications of proof. Thus, in all conditions of life and death, we are met by the color line. Douglas was especially embittered, at least for the moment, when his home was destroyed by fire in Rochester in 1872. Upon arriving there from Washington, where he was editing the New National Era, he sought a room in two of the nearest hotels. At both, he was greeted with the statement that, "We are full," until it was known that he was Frederick Douglass. Then a room was readily offered to him. He did not accept the room in either place. He went to the headquarters of the police to inquire about the whereabouts of his family that had been hastily displaced as a result of the fire. Such a treatment as this, Douglass asserted, does not tend to make a man secure either in his person or his property. The spirit which would deny a man shelter in a public house needs little but change to deny him shelter even in his own house. It is the spirit of hate, the spirit of murder, the spirit which would burn a family in its own bed. I may be wrong, he concluded, but I fear that the sentiment that repelled me at Congress Hall burnt my house. The history of education of Negroes in the United States is the history of deprivation, segregation, and discrimination. In the post-Reconstruction years, there was never a time anywhere in the United States where educational opportunities for Negroes even approached the opportunities provided for whites. In the North, where the Negro was regularly shunted off into ghettos, the educational policy for Negroes was characterized by inferior programs and even an astonishing neglect of those. Only when there were insufficient numbers of Negroes for separate schools did Negroes freely attend schools with whites. Even in such situations, Negroes were regularly and systematically discouraged from pursuing advanced and college preparatory courses. Meanwhile, in the South, where most Negroes lived until the period following World War I, segregation in education was universal, and discrimination was the pattern. School boards spent 5 to 10 times more for the education of white children than for the education of Negro children. As though such discrimination was not enough, the United States Supreme Court in 1899 upheld the contention of a Georgia school board that when there were insufficient funds for high schools for both Negroes and whites, it could use its funds to provide a high school for whites and no high school for Negroes. The pattern of segregation and discrimination was to persist down to the middle of the 20th century. Not until 1954 did the United States Supreme Court challenge the time-honored practices by declaring that segregation in public schools was unconstitutional. Then it ordered the desegregation of those schools with all deliberate speed. And for the next decade and more, ingenious methods to evade the court's decree were devised all over the country. In the South, the methods took the form of massive resistance, pupil placement laws, freedom of choice policies. They succeeded in keeping more than 90% of the schools racially segregated. In the North, the practices took the form of gerrymandering the boundaries of school districts, of constructing new schools at points where the school population would be inevitably racially homogeneous. Then, as the last resort, of deserting the inner city for the more attractive bucolic life of the ever-retreating homogeneous suburbs. The pace of desegregation continued to be so very slow that a decade later, the court could remark that there had been more deliberateness than speed in following its decree. And in 1967, the United States Commission on Civil Rights, after carefully studying the trends in school desegregation, lashed out at what it called the racial isolation caused by de facto segregation, and then reiterated its earlier contention that schools in which Negro children predominate operate under the most severe handicaps. The views on education so recently expressed by the Supreme Court of the United States and by the United States Civil Rights Commission are essentially the views which Douglass held. And his statements on the subject could well have been submitted to the commission during its hearings on education. First, Douglass would make certain that no obstacles, no distractions should beset the young in their pursuit of an education. The ignorance of any part of the American people so deeply concerns all the rest, he said, that there can be no doubt of the right to pass laws compelling the attendance of every child at school. Believing that such is now required and ought to be enacted, we hereby put ourselves on record in favor of stringent laws to this end. Secondly, Douglass believed that the task of public education was so stupendous and so important that it required the total resources of the nation to achieve its desired goals. Thus, when the ill-fated Blair Bill to provide federal aid to education was before Congress in 1890, Douglass was one of its most ardent supporters. Recognizing the bitter opposition on the part of many white Southerners in Congress, Douglass reminded them that the bill would benefit white illiterates as well as Negro illiterates. To me, he said, it is a bill in the interest of both races, and is of a tendency to do away with the spirit of caste and of sectionalism, and to promote the general welfare of diffusing knowledge and enlightenment in the darkest corners of the Republic, where it is most needed, and where the people are the least able to secure such knowledge for themselves. In the third place, Douglass had no illusions about the evil consequences of segregated education, and he consistently struggled to eliminate it. He was delighted, therefore, when Charles Sumner, Senator from Massachusetts, in 1870, proposed in his civil rights bill to abolish segregation in all of the public schools of the United States. Douglas said, "Educate the white children and the colored children together. Let them grow up to know that color makes no difference as to the rights of a man, that both the black man and the white man are at home, that the country is as much the country of one as of the other, and that both together must make it a valuable country. We want mixed schools," Douglas continued, "not because our colored schools are inferior to white schools, not because colored instructors are inferior to white instructors, but because we want to do away with a system which exalts one class and debases another. We looked to mixed schools to teach that worth and ability are to be the criterion of manhood and not race and color." Douglas was therefore bitterly disappointed when the Southern leaders coalesced with the Northern philanthropists to force Congress to delete the provision for the desegregation of schools from the Civil Rights Act that finally passed 5 years after it was introduced in 1875. There were no educational opportunities, however attractive, that equipped the masses of Negroes to live in their communities and to make a decent livelihood there in the last quarter of the 19th century. The vast majority of Negroes still in the rural areas of the South and without means to become independent farmers eked out an existence as seasonal day laborers and as sharecroppers. The minority that lived in the urban centers of the South soon discovered that most of the doors of opportunity in the new industries were closed to them. In the North, the Negroes were compelled to compete with the vast numbers of immigrants from Europe and with white migrants from the rural areas. And invariably, the Negro was at some disadvantage. He did not have the requisite skills, or he had no references, or he was not a union member, or there were not enough Negro workers to make up a separate work team, or something else. Negroes, some claim, could not learn to operate expensive and complicated machinery. Others said that Negroes were not reliable. And most agreed that if there were not enough jobs to go around, then the Negro had to be left out. The patterns of discrimination and employment were well formed by the time of the death of Douglas. And with the increase in the number of Negroes in urban centers in the 20th century, the situation became more acute. Soon, such cities such as New York and Chicago and Philadelphia and Baltimore and Cleveland had hundreds of thousands of Negroes looking for work, and the percentage of unemployed among Negroes steadily increased. When they gained employment during a strike, they were denounced by the unions as scabs who had no appreciation for the principles and problems of the labor movement. When there was no strike and they sought membership in the unions, they were excluded for one reason or another. That was, in fact, an exclusion based entirely on race. Except during periods of extraordinary demands on labor, such as during a world war, Negroes experienced untold difficulties in securing substantially gainful employment. And even during the war, racial discrimination in employment persisted. Meanwhile, Negro women had more success in securing gainful, if demeaning and poorly paid employment, than the men. The dire consequences, in terms of the disintegration of the family and the juvenile delinquency and the loss of pride on the part of the Negro men, were incalculable. During the past 10 years, the Commission on Civil Rights has taken a close look at employment discrimination, and it has reached the inescapable conclusion that discrimination exists in industry, in the labor unions, and even in the federal establishment itself. In 1960, the rate of unemployment for Negroes was twice that of the white population. In some cities, more than one-third of the Negro workforce was unemployed. Discrimination in education and training further contributed to the ability of Negroes to secure their requisite skills, while discrimination against them in apprenticeship training often resulted in complete exclusion from employment opportunities. Nothing points up the nature and the extent of the problem more than the fact that the relative economic position of the Negro has not significantly improved in the past 20 years. No one felt more deeply than Douglass the bitter experience of discrimination in employment, and no one spoke more feelingly about it. And it was a deeply personal feeling, so far as he was concerned. His son, Lewis Douglass, the printer, was unable to secure employment for many months because of discrimination against him. He was refused a job because it was claimed that at one time he worked at a lower rate of wages than that had been fixed by the printers' union, and that he had worked in a city, Rochester, where the union existed and where he did not become a member. His son, Douglass, said, was made a transgressor for working at a low rate of wages by the very men who prevented him from getting a high rate. Douglass continued, "My son is denounced for not being a member of the printers' union by the very men who would not permit him to join the printers' union. He is not condemned because he is a good printer. He is not a good printer. He is not condemned because he is not a good printer. There is no disguising the fact. His crime was his color. It was his color in Denver, where he was unable to get the work. It was his color in Rochester, and it is his color in Washington today. But the strictures of Douglass against the employers and the unions went far beyond his criticisms of the mistreatment of his own son. He noted the universal nature of discrimination in employment. The Negro, he said, is rejected by trade unions of every trade and refused work while he lives and burial when he dies, and yet he is asked to forget his color and forget that which everyone else remembers. If he offers himself to be a builder as a mechanic, to a client as a lawyer, to a patient as a physician, to a college as a professor, to a firm as a clerk, to a government department as an agent or an officer, he is sternly met by the color line, and his claim to consideration in some way is disputed on the ground of color. No arguments offered in support of the recent legislation and the recent executive orders calling for fair practices in employment, no arguments have been more telling than those that were advanced by Douglass 75 years ago. The last years of Douglass were years of peculiar humiliation and degradation of Negro Americans in general. Segregation statutes in the southern states increased in number and in absurdity following the striking down of the Civil Rights Act of 1883. In the northern states, segregation and discrimination were almost as widespread. Lynch law replaced all semblances of due process, and it appeared that the courts would be closed to Negroes as far as so-called serious crimes were concerned. In the cities, mobs hunted down Negroes and insulted them, taunted them, even killed them. These were the embryos of the race riots that were to flare up and to flourish during the decade following the death of Douglass. There were Wilmington, North Carolina, and Statesboro, Georgia, Atlanta, Georgia, and Brownsville, Texas, Springfield, Ohio, Springfield, Illinois. It seemed a waste of time to try Negroes for rape. So when a mob insisted on taking out an accused Negro, the only advice that a South Carolina governor could give the mob was that they should observe the proprieties. Even in the 20th century, accused Negroes seldom enjoyed the advice of counsel. Frequently, they had confessions extorted from them under the most incredibly brutal circumstances, And, of course, they enjoyed no rights that an innocent citizen was entitled to enjoy until he was proved guilty. The first quarter of the 20th century was a period of despair for the Negro soldiers in Brownsville, Texas, whom President Theodore Roosevelt dishonorably discharged because of the rights there said that they had shot up the town. The Senate investigation and the subsequent exoneration of the soldiers many years later did not make amends for the cruel injustices to which they had been subjected without semblance of even an inquiry. It was a period of despair for the Negro defendants of Elaine, Arkansas, who had no legal counsel, who were tried in a mob atmosphere and convicted after a jury deliberated for 5 minutes. It was no expiation of the crime of a miscarriage of justice that the Supreme Court some years later threw out the convictions of those Negroes on the obvious ground that there hadn't been the slightest due process of law. The maladministration, so far as Negro Americans were concerned, was inevitably the concern of the United States Civil Rights Commission when it began its work in 1957. And in the following decade, between then and now, the commission was to discover and to expose scores upon scores of cases involving the miscarriage of justice, ranging from what it called unlawful police violence to private violence, and then to jury exclusion. It found that handcuffed Negroes had been shot while in the custody of police, that some unarmed Negroes had been blackjacked to death as they resisted arrest, and that Negro prisoners had been killed in their jail cells under circumstances that were at best mysterious. Douglas classified all such actions as the operation of lynch law. Everyone knows that what is called lynch law, he said, is peculiarly the law for colored people and for nobody else. The crime of insolence, for which the Negro was formerly killed and for which his killing was justified, he said, is as easily pleaded in excuse now as it was in the slavery time. And what is worse now, it is sufficient to make the charge of insolence to provoke the knife or the bullet. This done, it is then only necessary to say in the newspapers that this dead Negro was impudent and about to raise an insurrection or kill all the white people, or that a white woman was insulted by a Negro. This is all that is necessary to lull the conscience of the white people of the North into indifference and to reconcile the people in the South to such murder. No proof of guilt, he said, is required. It is enough to accuse, to condemn, to punish the accused with death. When the accused is dead and silent, and the murderer is alive and at large, he has it all his own way. It will well be remembered that at the close of the Civil War, there was no widespread clamor to extend the suffrage to the freedmen. President Andrew Johnson in 1866 described the radicals as being wildly in favor of Negro suffrage, but of course, President Johnson was overstating the case somewhat. When 2 years following the Civil War, the Negroes were given the franchise, it was done begrudgingly, and only because the intransigent and uncooperative attitudes of the Southerners in power indicated to Congress that there was no other way. Although many contemporaries would claim, and many poor students of history would later assert, that Negroes wielded great political power during Reconstruction, that, of course, also is an error. But the possession of the franchise by Negroes, even for the brief period known as Reconstruction, was enough to establish and perpetuate the view that the vote in the hands of Negroes is a dangerous and sinister thing. When Southern whites returned to power in the mid-70s, they could not wait to launch the move to drive the Negroes from political involvement altogether. In defiance of the 15th Amendment, they developed a whole set of devious and cunning practices that made the Negroes' vote ineffective. And finally, beginning in 1890, with the Mississippi Constitutional Convention, one Southern state after another revised the suffrage provisions of its constitutions in order to make virtually impossible the exercise of the franchise by Negroes. Then, to make the matter doubly sure, They proceed to exclude Negroes from the Democratic white primary, where all the important political decisions in the South were being made anyway. Then there ensued a half century of effort on the part of the Negro to secure the vote in the Southern states. In 1915, the so-called Grandfather Clause was declared unconstitutional. From that point on, otherwise disqualified voters could not vote merely because their grandfathers were voting in 1866. Since no Negroes were voting in 1866, the Grandfather Clause had permitted only whites to vote. Then, after the Grandfather Clause was declared unconstitutional, there followed an assault on the Democratic white primary that began in 1923 and that ended in its final destruction in 1947. Then followed the slow, persistent effort to force white registrars in the South to enroll Negro voters. The Commission on Civil Rights discovered in its hearings in Louisiana and Mississippi and other Southern states that there were widespread practices by which registrars simply excluded Negroes from registering to vote. They were ruled out because they could not spell, or because they could not interpret the Constitution, or because they could not quote the Constitution. The commission even discovered that one of the registrars who disqualified a Negro because he could not spell did not spell the word spell correctly in her report. The work of the NAACP and the Congress of Racial Equality, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, and the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee in conducting voter registration drives in the South did much in these years to point up the widespread practices of excluding Negroes from voting. Douglas, of course, was one of the earliest and most consistent advocates of suffrage for Negroes. In April 1865, the very month that the Civil War ended, Douglas made an eloquent plea for the extension of the franchise to Negroes. "We want the vote," he said, "because it is our right, first of all. No class of men, without insulting their own nature, can be content with any deprivation of their rights. And we want the vote as a means of educating our race. By depriving us of suffrage, you affirm our incapacity to form an intelligent judgment respecting public men and public measures. You declare before the world that we are unfit to exercise the elective franchise, and by this means lead us to undervalue ourselves, to put a low estimate upon ourselves." Douglas was greatly pained in the days following Reconstruction to hear the arguments that Negroes should be disfranchised because they were ignorant and because they had misused political power. He said that this was utter nonsense to claim that Negro suffrage was the cause of the failure of the governments of the South. "It is not the ignorance of the Negro," he said, "but the malevolence of his accusers, which is the real cause of the Southern disorders. It is easy to show that the illiteracy of the Negro has no part or lot in the disturbances there. They who contend for disfranchisement on this ground know, and they know very well, that there is no truth whatsoever in their contention. To make out their case, they must show that some oppressive and hurtful measure has been imposed upon the country by the Negro voters. But they cannot show any such thing, and they know it." Because of the persistence of the evils which Douglas attacked, he spoke to our generation as well as to his own. His faith in his country and his commitment to its institutions were never shaken, even when it seemed that it was impossible to make any significant headway against the ever-present and rancorous evil of prejudice. Because he recognized the nature of the problem, he could face it with greater understanding and with greater resoluteness. "Few evils," he said on one occasion, "are less accessible to the force of reason, or more tenacious of life and power, than a long-standing prejudice. It is a moral disorder that creates the conditions necessary to its own existence, and fortifies itself by refusing all contradiction. It paints a hateful picture according to its own diseased imagination, and distorts the features of the fancied original to suit the portrait. As those who believe in the visibility of ghosts can easily see them, so it is always easy to see repulsive qualities in those we despise and hate. The remedies for the conditions created by racial prejudice and conflict were implicit in Douglass's analysis of the conditions. The public must make available the kind of education, the kind of training for every citizen that will make it possible for the citizen to function effectively in a free society. There must be fair employment that recognizes skills and not color as the basis for the effective performance of required tasks. The government should be strong enough and honorable enough to protect the rights of the weak as well as the strong. And every citizen must have the full and free opportunity to exercise the franchise in order to secure that better government which will effectively administer justice to all. Every citizen should employ every reasonable means to secure the enjoyment of every civil right that is enjoyed by every other citizen. It was his understanding of the problems that his people and his country faced, and it was the ceaseless efforts that he made to solve them that caused the Rochester Chronicle in 1879 to insist that he must rank among the greatest of men, not only of this city, but of the nation as well, great in gifts, greater in utilizing them, great in his inspiration, greater in his efforts for humanity, great in the persuasion of his speech, greater in the purpose that informed it. Douglass has recently been called the father of the Civil Rights Revolution. This is a sobriquet not easily won nor lightly conferred. It was won because of the consonance of his views and actions with those who today seek equality. It was conferred because of the growing recognition that his counsel and his leadership are as fresh and as effective as they were 75 years ago. A young contemporary Negro poet, Paul Laurence Dunbar, spoke of Douglass for his own generation and for succeeding generations, including our own, when he said, "And he was no soft-tongued apologist. He spoke straightforward, fearlessly uncowed. The sunlight of his truth dispelled the mist and set in bold relief each dark-hued cloud. To sin and crime, he gave their proper hue and hurled at evil what was evil's due." Thank you. This is quite clear on this all the way through. Despite the fact that he was as critical and more eloquently critical, I think, of a social order than anyone today, than anyone speaking or writing today, he recognized the fact so clearly, from his point of view at least, that isolation of any kind or retreat from cooperation of any kind was deadly to the civil rights movement generally, and inimical to the interests of the nation as a whole. He never retreated from the proffer of assistance by any well-meaning element of the population which sought to extend its hand. And indeed, it was his view that only in that way would it be possible for the nation as a whole to move forward and achieve equality. It's interesting, I think, and this is terribly relevant. It's interesting to observe in this connection that the kind of a peculiar pride of race that is bandied about today was not shared by Douglass. Douglass was not concerned very much about race. As a matter of fact, he not only thought but believed and hoped that race as we know it would disappear, that you wouldn't have Negroes and whites and all that. And since he himself was both, he hoped that in time all people would be both. Negro and white, so that he could not, it's inconceivable to me that he could have brought himself to the kind of pride of race that would have rejected and isolated, rejected one race and resulted in the isolation of his own race, legally his own race, from the rest. What else did you ask me? Oh, they're rather similar to Douglass's, I'm afraid. what are my views on black power? He said, I forgot to repeat the questions. Of course, let me say, first, my general view, I must say, that that there is vagueness and, from my point of view, fuzziness in the concept and the definition. I don't know really what it means. I've been in correspondence with various people at the National Office of SNCC. I just try to understand. I've been reading the literature. I don't know. I think it comes from, I think the concept comes from, if I may say so, a lack of knowledge of history anyway. To the extent that it calls for a mobilization of the effective resources and the power of the Negro community to improve their own lot. They're 150 years late, you see, because certainly David Walker said it, I think, more eloquently and obviously much more bitterly in 1828 than anyone said it recently. And people like Martin Delaney and Frederick Douglass and Henry McNeil Turner and a whole host of others have advocated this with great vigor and great eloquence for literally for centuries. The desire to utilize the intellectual, the political, the economic, and other resources of the Negro community to improve their own lot is, I'm sorry to say, rather old hat. But good old hat. the new wrinkle, and this is not new either, is the rejection of the rejection of equal cooperation, as I understand at least some of the so-called black power leaders, the rejection of equal cooperation on the part of the white community in with them in their quest for equality. But of course, this is a page out of the book of Paul Cuffey, of a later Henry McNeil Turner, and a later Martin Delaney, and of course, Marcus Garvey and the whole lot of them who turned their backs on the white community and said, you know, we don't trust you, we don't believe in you, and we're going it alone. That's not new either. I can only suggest that it seems to have a somewhat impractical and built-in futile program, since it, if it rejects the proffer of white cooperation, it suggests at the same time the consolidation or the polarization of the two groups, and of course, it means that we'll take ours where we are strong, and we concede to you by the same token, you can have yours where you are strong. Well, the areas where we are strong are relatively few. It's all right, you get a sheriff in Macon County, Mississippi. In Macon County, Alabama. You get a sheriff in Macon County, Alabama, and that's black power. And congratulations, I'm delighted. But by the way in which it was got and the ideology that was developed and the sentiment that was created certainly had the effect of making it difficult, impossible for the Negro to use his vote effectively in anywhere, in any area where he had
anything less than
an overwhelming majority. And it, of course, means that when, since you don't have a majority in the state, it means that as long as Lurleen Wallace is sitting up there, she can appoint 50 constables into Macon County, Alabama, as a kind of response to the black power influence. And the sheriff will be relatively ineffective, I would say, in the circumstances. So from that point of view, I think that it has some self-defeating ideas and programs within it, built in. But I don't really know. It goes back. Oh, I'm sorry. I was suggesting it was implied in some remark that I made that the problem of race relations, the difficulties in connection with the races getting along, extends back into the past, at least back to Douglas's time. And the gentleman is raising the question that as a person who grew up in the 30s was not aware of it, and why wasn't he aware of it? I don't know. It's sort of like, I know this is a dangerous comment to make in Rochester, but I'm going to make it, that it was sort of like President, this story might be apocryphal, but it's worth telling. When President Eisenhower suggested to Ralph Bunche that he ought to come to Washington and become a member of the administration, it is said that Bunche said that I left Washington because of segregation and I just don't want to come back. And it is said that President, segregation? What segregation? What's he talking about? I can only say that there were some people in the 30s who were aware of it. But the interesting thing about it, I suspect there will be some in the 60s and 70s who will not be aware of it if they have their way. That is, that we have had the facility, certainly for the past several generations, of growing up in insulation. We have two, I wrote on this not long ago, two separate worlds of race. And the point is that the subordinate, the so-called subordinate race, because it has to have a certain kind of contact with the other race, is much more aware of that race than that race is aware of it. So that, for example, the Negroes have known more, Negroes always know about more about whites than whites know about Negroes, although the whole approach to the problem of race relations on the part of whites is that they know the Negroes, but they don't know anything about them, really. That, for example, Negroes know about how whites live day and night, or around the clock. Whites don't know how to live, how Negroes live. And one, therefore, who lives in a white world can grow up, as I say, insulated, literally insulated. And particularly is this true if one grows up in what I called earlier a homogeneous community. And that's not a nice word used in this context from my point of view. A homogeneous community where everything is so, you know, peaceful and quiet, there's no violence in the streets and no anything going on, and the Negro is the invisible man. He is the phantom in the eyes of the Republic. He just isn't quite there. He's not known. For example, I shall never forget that when
a very distinguished historian, a friend of mine, invited me in, back a few years ago to at the Library of Congress, where we both had study rooms, to meet him for lunch the next day, and I said, sure, fine. And I went back to work, and it hit me all of a sudden that tomorrow was Saturday. And I ran around to his office, and I said, look, we can't have lunch tomorrow. It's Saturday, you know. He said, Saturday, yeah. I said, you know, the Supreme Court restaurant is closed on Saturday. And it's a long way to the Union Station. That's the other place Negroes can eat. He said, you know, this is in the 50s. The dawn is breaking on him. He says, you'll be down tomorrow? I said, yes, sure. Come to the library on Saturday. He said, but eating, what do you do? I said, well, you know, you arrange. I said, you come about an hour later, you eat a late breakfast, and come an hour later, and you work, you bring an apple or something, you work, and finally you eat that apple, and then you hope that'll last until later on, and then when you can't stand it, you leave, but you try to stretch out the day. He said, is this what it takes to be a Negro historian? No, what kind of... This is a one of the most distinguished historians of the South. What I'm trying to suggest to you is that that he had no notion of the problem, so to speak. He'd grown up into the 50s. In the 1950s, and had become one of the nation's great historians, studying the problem of the South every day of his life, and was not aware of the fact. You know, an ordinary meat and bread problem like that, which was all around us, and which could inform him about the problem of race relations in Washington and the nation's capital, and the problem of trying to live as a Negro scholar and all the rest of it. Now, what I'm trying to suggest is how you can even, now you don't even have to go to the suburbs in the lovely, homogeneous place where there's no Negroes, and you look out your window every day to see. You know, to be certain that there are not any. You don't have to do that. You can live in the middle of a teeming community like the nation's capital, where the problem is enormous and gigantic, and not know it. Thus, one, I think, informs itself as a result of a curiosity or an interest or something else, or one stumbles into it, maybe sometimes accidentally. But one has the feeling that it's getting somewhat more difficult to be impervious to it, if I may use the term. It's getting somewhat
difficult.
I don't know which job you're talking about, but would I comment on the relationship between this question and what we have been trying to do, I think I do know now, in editing some materials that would be available to all young people. Several years ago, my editor at Double N Company asked me if I would be willing to join in a project that would look toward the publication of materials on minority groups. President Wallace referred to it in passing. That would assist people generally in understanding and knowing more about who the minority groups are, and what they do, how they live, and what their problems are, and what has been their relationship to the larger community. So we've been publishing for about 2 years now a series of books. I believe we've got about 9 or 10 out now, which talk about individual members of minority and ethnic minority groups, and as well as certain segments of
the history of these groups. We're working now on Puerto Ricans, we're working on Mexicans, we've been working primarily on Negroes up to now. So we've got books like Worth Fighting For, which is the story of Negroes in Civil War and Reconstruction. And we've got books like Pioneers and Patriots, which tell about Negroes in the Revolutionary period. We've got books on the much more recent period of the 20s, 30s, and 40s. One would hope that the young people, if they have the opportunity to read in this area, they would be more informed, and that you might get some breaking down of the insulation that has been so present so long. Yes. Whose culture is this? The question is, that one of the ways, perhaps, in which Negroes could commend themselves to a much larger group, and the way in which they could be more better received, would be to build up what has been described here as the Negro culture, to, I suppose you would say, put one's best foot forward, so to speak. Because you see, the difficulty with my dealing with this is that I don't believe in Negro culture. Negroes have been in this country for 300 years, longer than any but just a few. Just a few people, longer than any, just a few. Negroes got here in 1619, and by the way, they were free, not slaves. Now, the process by which Negroes came to this country was an interesting one, which could preoccupy us here, but I won't permit it to. But over the next 2.5 centuries, many millions of Negroes were brought here, hundreds of thousands of millions. Now, this process involved one of the most barbarous uprootings of a people in the history of the human race. It meant the pulling of this African from this community, and this child from that other community, and another child, or another person from another community. You go all the way around until you got your shipload. And you have on this ship people from as many different cultures as there are culture regions, perhaps, in Africa. And there are many, speaking different languages, having different religions, different cultures of every conceivable kind. Now, you bring a crowd like that into the Charleston Harbor, or into Boston Harbor, as they've got many, and you offer them for sale, and they're scattered to the 10 winds, and within a generation, you don't have any African culture at all. You see, you don't have any. There's no language left, there's no religion left, there's no anything left. Now, what we've got developed here is certainly not African culture. Plenty of my African nationalist friends will argue with me about this, but I've been looking all around. I don't find much African culture. What you've got here is then a remarkable acculturation of the Negro and the white people of this country, with the Negroes having contributed something to the general culture and having been affected greatly by the whites, and vice versa. A lot of people believe that, you know, that there is such, the Negroes have some kind of religion, a religious experience, a religious manifestations. Because there is no religious manifestation that Negroes have that are not a part of the manifestation of the culture of which they are a part, which is Southern Baptist culture or Methodist culture. And Negroes learn how to shout from whites. It was whites who rolled on the floor and spoke the unknown tongue and saw Jesus, you see. Now, there were some experiences such as the way in which they responded to their travail, which I think can be more specifically identified with the Negro community, and that is, of course, more than any other one thing, the spirituals and the work songs that came out of their cultural stuff. Now, I do not know that there is any great deprecation of that on the part of Negroes themselves. To the extent that there is, I deplore it. I have great difficulty, and I'm not being facetious, I don't want anyone to get the impression, I have great difficulty in ferreting out, and I study this constantly, in ferreting out and identifying things that I could call Negro culture. I really do have difficulty in it, because Negroes go to the schools, they have the language, they have the religion, they have the orientation, they have the background, and the other things of Europe. We cannot say that there is any similarity between, say, Irish Americans and African Americans. Not. It is the Irish have roots that they can trace and that are clearly identified, and that over these roots and over this path comes a culture leaping out of County Cork. There is no direct line coming out of, you know, Nigeria, or you name it, but just this. So that what you have here is an intermixture that is Western. Yes, some of it's America, some of it's Negro, but it's part. It's what we have been talking about when we say talk about the melting pot and all the rest of it. Negroes have put their bit in with the rest. It's hard if it has been blended. It's hard to sort of pull it out and identify it. Unless you've had a conscious identification of self over a period of time. And Negroes were denied that privilege by the very process of the dehumanization of slavery.
All of you got the question. Do you need me to repeat the question? No.
isn't it possible that the development of a program of black power will at least raise the level of the Negro to a position of equality so that he can deal with his, quote, adversaries, unquote, or his colleagues, I should say, unquote, as peers? I wish that you had been more specific, program-wise, anyway, because I'm not at all certain how the objective of equality is to be achieved. You could speak of black power, but that doesn't do it. You can speak of the amassing of political power, but as I suggested, Negroes have been wanting to do that. I remember so well 25 years ago when I belonged to the Durham Committee on Negro Affairs in Durham, North Carolina, where I was teaching. We met every week or two to be certain that we had all the votes, you know, to make ourselves felt in the community. And this is what I think Negroes have been doing and are doing all along. I just don't know what it is. Of course, I gather that you're not suggesting this makes Negroes themselves feel more equal, but it makes whites recognize them more as equals, I suppose. Certainly Negroes. Well, what? Well, I don't know. How do you do that? To the extent that Negroes want to get together and pool their resources, I suppose that's a way. I have difficulty, and I don't. I wish I didn't have difficulty. I have difficulty in knowing what you mean. In this same community which I spoke of, there of course are a large number of Negro businesses. Multimillionaire businesses. The president of the largest of these complexes is going to speak on this series in a few weeks from now, and I commend his career to you. It's a fantastic career. Now, to the extent that the North Carolina Mutual Life Insurance Company has been able to amass and accumulate an enormous amount of wealth and resources and build the biggest building that exists in Durham, North Carolina today, the only one you can see from 21 miles away. It has made itself felt, and I suppose it exerts a kind of equality. Having at least followed that company for 30 years or more, it has never been involved in what might be described as alienation of any kind. Quite the contrary, as some of my friends who are here with me will know. Quite the contrary, it is solicited and sought the kind of cooperation and the kind of greenback, or George Washington, as you said, that would give it this strength. And it's done this by all kinds of means. I hope you ask Ms. Spaulding some of the methods that they've used. I happen to know some about them privately. This is, I think, not what is being suggested now. I don't understand that it is, although this is a very powerful company with millions and millions of dollars worth of resources. But it didn't get them with the kind of technique that, as I understand, is being suggested here. Alienation, you know. I think it's not even smart, not terribly smart. If you and I put ours together, it's not a great deal, I don't think. unless your resources are unexpectedly large. But the extension of your and my, the projection of your and my activities into a larger sphere, where we can involve ourselves, not necessarily in a position of obsequious kowtowing to the business community, but where we can involve ourselves in programs that will get for us more of what you're talking about. It seems to me that is precisely what might lead to the kind of economic power
which you were talking about. I praise the prospect of the Negro's becoming infinitely more economically powerful than he is. But simply to jump up and say black power and we're going to do it ourselves is not in itself highly imaginative from a programmatic point of view. Yes. Ellen. What is that? I'm sorry. So the Negro doesn't what? Oh, doesn't have the respect. Would you tell me the manner in which Douglass was able to secure the respect of, I gather that you were suggesting that he enjoyed the respect. And his life is what? It means what now to you? I'm just trying to understand. Now, what is the lesson to be learned from, say, the 1870s and 80s, which you were talking about when, with the reinstitution of control over Negroes by Southerners? I gather that's what you mean by saying reinstituted. They didn't reinstitute slavery, but something almost as bad. Now, what is the lesson to be learned? Are you suggesting that that Negroes did not resist this? And if they had been violent, well, there are a number of ways in which to gain respect, and all of them are not along the route of violence. Mr. Douglass is an example. I was trying to understand what the example of his life was. Now, let me make this comment in conclusion, and that is that that it is my general view that we do not fully understand or appreciate what Negroes in the past have done to make it possible for
us to be where we are at this time. It takes an enormous amount of courage to picket in 1915 in Mississippi, in Memphis, Tennessee, but Negroes were doing it. It took an enormous amount of courage for Negroes to walk up to the ballot box and vote in the 1890s, but they were doing it in defiance of all of the power that was being flung down in their faces. And all along the line, I think sometimes we tend to believe that we invented even a technique, to say nothing of an aspiration, in 1960. And these inventions rest on more than a century of the most vigorous, relentless, persistent struggles to secure equality, and they didn't end on dead center either. They didn't end on dead center either. The Negro has taught this nation a great deal about itself and about what it ought to do. And in the process, the Negro's position, if you can say what you want to, the Negro's position is immeasurably improved in 1960, you name the date, over what it was the decade before or the decade before that. Now, in the process of teaching, it might have brought the lesson to this country that the path of victory is by being human beings, too, you see. It was the Negro slaves in Connecticut in 1776 who flung into the teeth of the people of the United States the inconsistency of fighting on the one hand for political independence and maintaining slavery on the other, and they've confounded and troubled this nation from that day to this. Now, you gain respect in all kinds of ways, and the record will show that you gain that they've gained respect in the legislative halls of this country. They've gained respect in the Supreme Court of the United States of this country, where you can smile and laugh and be as indifferent as you can, as you want to. Wouldn't be in any position to talk about anything had not there been a succession of fantastic victories in the United States Supreme Court, beginning in 1915, then in 1921, 1917, Buchanan against Warren, the housing ordinance declared unconstitutional, right down Moore against Dempsey in 1921, which is the first victory in the whole area of due process. You get due process applied by at least 90% of the country, you can get respect of the law. All of these things have been achieved in an orderly way. And you know, somehow I have the feeling, I could go on and document that further, but I have the feeling that there might be the new feeling that even in the darkest days of modernism, someone might show a great superiority, and at least at long last might create a sense of wonderment if they act like human beings. And it might be the great gift, of black folks to act like human beings in this sea of barbarism.
Next week's talk will be by Whitney Young. This meeting is adjourned. I hope to see you all here next week.